Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Steve Brown, in for Tiziana Deering. And we start with the signing of the Inflation Reduction Act into law, which, despite its name, is actually being called a potential turning point in how we tackle climate change. Here's Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey on the floor of the Senate earlier this month, urging his fellow Democrats to approve the measure.
Every night on every TV station, the lead stories are floods and fires and every other imaginable consequence of climate change. And it is time. The moment has arrived. And the United States Senate, with only Democratic support, is ready to take the action that the younger generation in our country has been waiting for.
President Biden signed the IRA yesterday, but ultimately the compromise has been met with mixed reactions. Here to talk more about that and some other major news this week is Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton. He represents the 6th District. Congressman Moulton, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be back. Thanks.
Let's start with the Inflation Reduction Act, which President Biden signed into law yesterday. Many, including your colleague, Senator Ed Markey, has celebrated its passage. He called it, quote, a historic piece of legislation. It is the funding we need for the health of the planet and the funding we need for the health of families. This bill is going to move us from a dirty economy to a clean economy. Do you share his optimism, Congressman? And is this going to make that big an impact?
I think it's an incredibly important first step. And the reality is that we've failed as the United States Congress, as the United States government, to address climate change for 20 or 30 years now. So this isn't going to solve every issue. There are a lot of things we still need to do. I would have liked to see a lot of money for high-speed rail, for example, the most carbon-friendly type of transportation in the world today. And it didn't have that in the bill. I'm not saying it's a perfect bill, but it's a huge step forward, especially given our reluctance to take any steps in the past.
Mm-hmm. Any concerns that it'll drive up energy costs, gas prices, and so on?
No, actually, I think it'll be quite the opposite. If Americans have more options, if there's more competition, if we have green energy sources as a viable option to compete with gas and oil, then we're going to be much better off. And most importantly, we're not going to be beholden to foreign dictators setting the price of oil. The oil price skyrocketed when this crazy man, Vladimir Putin, invaded Ukraine. We can't be beholden to crazy guys like Vladimir Putin. We need to set our own price for energy, and we're going to do that by having more options for the American consumer.
Yeah. You said you'd like to see a little bit more than what is in the IRA. Is there an appetite in Congress for an IRA 2? I know the first one was just signed yesterday, but is that something that you expect to see in the next session?
Sadly, I don't think there's an appetite for that right now. And obviously, we want to give some time to see how this works. It's also important to note that this bill was paid for by closing loopholes so that billionaire corporations, you know, finally pay their minimum share of income tax. It's not going to raise taxes on the average American family, but it is going to close a lot of loopholes. We want to make sure that that all works. So I think it's reasonable to give time for this bill to succeed, for it to start having an impact on the economy. No piece of legislation is perfect. Let's see what works, what could be improved. And then we'll talk about further climate and investment opportunities in the future.
How do you measure success in the short run with this?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think it would be helpful if the Biden administration set out some benchmarks where we can see this happening. I want to see that these tax loopholes are actually closed. It's frustrating that my family pays more in federal taxes than some of the largest corporations in the world today. I want to see that changed. I also want to see the result of these climate investments. Let's see if they lead to meaningful reductions in carbon. Maybe it will be even more successful than planned, or maybe it won't live quite up to our expectations. Either way, we need to have some benchmarks to see the success of this legislation so that we can improve it down the road.
Mm-hmm. Democrats did have to compromise, though, in order to secure support from fellow Democrat Joe Manchin from West Virginia. There were incentives and subsidies added around fossil fuels, which will likely lead to new pipelines and more drilling for oil and gas. What do you say to those who are concerned the party sacrificed too much to get this compromise?
This is the reality of politics today, is that it requires compromise. It's always required compromise in our system, and that's why no piece of legislation is ever perfect. But there's no question that this moves the ball forward significantly. And I agree. I didn't want to see subsidies for oil and gas, although there are some places, the Northeast being one of them, where more pipeline infrastructure would actually help reduce energy costs in the short term and could be used in the future for carbon-free sources like hydrogen. So it's not all bad, but we did have to make some compromises to get it done.
Mm-hmm. Often they say, you don't want perfect to be the enemy of the good. Is this a fine example of the good being good enough for right now?
I think it's not only good enough for right now, it's an important step forward for the future. Let's not underestimate the impact of the first major piece of climate legislation that the Congress has passed in a long time, and the first real investment in the green economy that we've made. So it's not just good, but you're right. The perfect can't be the enemy of the good. It's an appropriate time for that phrase. But I'm excited about this. I'm optimistic. And although there's still much work to be done and many things I would have liked to see included that were not, it's a huge positive step in the right direction. It's an investment in our future. It will improve the lives of everyday Americans. And you know what? That's why it's so popular around the country. A lot of Republicans don't really know how to respond to this because they see the Democrats actually getting things done rather than just complaining about what Disney is doing or spouting some new conspiracy theory, which seems to be what the Republican Party is focused on these days.
Do you expect to see some of your Republican colleagues out in their districts touting the benefits of this? Because there's going to be stuff from this bill that's going to affect folks in those districts. Do you think the Republicans will be out there taking credit for it?
I mean, that might have sounded like a crazy question 5 or 10 years ago, but it's not a crazy question now. It's a good question because, in fact, that's what Republicans did all across the country after we passed the bipartisan infrastructure law. They touted the benefits even when very few of them voted for it. So, yes, I expect that to happen again. Hypocrisy never seems to get in the way of a good story for Republican lawmakers.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton. Congressman, I want to check back in on an initiative that I know that you have long been passionate about, mental health. You were on the show about a month ago to talk about the launch of 988, a new mental health crisis hotline. At the time, there was some concern over the rollout and whether the states were ready. How's it gone so far?
Oh, it's gone incredibly well. And we knew that the rollout wouldn't be perfect, but it's about as close to perfect as you can get. We saw a 45% increase in national call volume between the transition week when the new hotline was brought online and the previous week. So that means over 96,000 calls, texts, and chats to this lifeline for people who are in need, you know, who need a helping hand in that moment of crisis. Over 45,000 Americans die every year by suicide, every one of them alone, and most because they just don't know who to reach out to in that critical moment. 988 is saving lives already.
Do you think we're moving towards getting away from the stigma of mental health?
We are absolutely making progress. I mean, when I shared my own story of dealing with post-traumatic stress after four tours in the Marine infantry in Iraq, I thought it might end my political career. And that was just a few years ago. But now it's really launched me on this crusade to help improve mental health care across America. And the fact that I was able to talk about this and it hasn't been used against me to attack me politically is just one example really close to home for me of how we are changing the stigma about mental health. But don't get me wrong, we've got a long way to go. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I were to tell you that I was going to get my annual physical right after this interview, no one would bat an eye. No one would say, oh my gosh, what's wrong? Are you okay, Seth? No, of course I'm fine. You just go to get your annual checkup regardless of whether anything's wrong. Now think about how different your thoughts might be if I said, I've got a mental health appointment right after this interview. You'd probably think, my gosh, is everything okay? Are you doing all right? Sure. We're a long way away from getting to the point where a mental health checkup is as routine as an annual physical. But that's where I want to be. That's where I want to bring this country. That's when we'll know that we really take care of our mental health. because it will make us a stronger country, a stronger nation. It will save a lot of lives, and we'll all be better. We'll be better at our jobs, at our whether it's being a dad or being a congressman or being a construction worker, whatever it is, you're going to be better at your job if you are in a good state of mind. Just like you know that if you work out, if you go to the gym, if you eat healthily, you're going to be in better shape. Mm-hmm. So we need to get to that same point with mental health where we're not afraid to talk about it and we proactively work to improve it.
Sure. There's been some pushback to the new 988 hotline across social media, with some posts warning folks not to call the number, expressing concerns over police involvement, involuntary treatment at emergency rooms or psychiatric hospitals, and the potential costs of those experiences, both financially and emotionally. What's your reaction to that pushback?
I mean, frankly, I think it's shameful because if you're discouraging people from getting help in a time of need, then you're not saving lives. You're doing the exact opposite. You're endangering lives. The truth is that only 1%, one out of every 100 calls to the Lifeline has police sent to a house because someone is in imminent danger because they can't come up with an alternative. And the caller doesn't want that help. So this is an incredibly rare occurrence. It's only when your life or the life of someone else is in imminent danger and they don't have a less invasive plan that can be worked out on the phone. The reality is that 99 out of 100 calls just address what the caller needs. They provide professional help in that moment of crisis to walk you back from the edge and get you the long-term assistance that you need. So look, no good deed goes unpunished. That's another good phrase that we can keep in mind. And there will always be critics. But make sure you're encouraging people to use 988, not the other way around, because it's saving lives every single day. I had my 1.5-year-old in the doctor's office yesterday for her checkup. And I was so thrilled to see 988 being advertised right there in the Salem doctor's office because people know that this is important and we've got to get out the word. And the more people who know about 988, the more people who have a conversation with their friends and loved ones about using that service if there's a crisis, the more lives we'll continue to save.
Will people get the same support after calling 988? And say if they live in Boston versus, you know, a small town in Western Mass that might not have, you know, they might, the police might be the only ones that could respond to something like that. Is it pretty much equal across the board?
Great question. Yes, it is, because the system that we have set up and why it took some time to actually establish this is a system where your call will go first to a local call center, like the Samaritans run call centers in Boston, for example. But if that call center is full, you'll get diverted to another call center somewhere else in the country that has an opening, because we want to make sure that every call gets answered. So just like when we established 911, we didn't want to have any holes in the system. We wanted to make sure that no matter where you called 911, you were going to reach someone who can help. We've established the same system for 988.
Let's shift gears a little bit, so to speak. The thing on a lot of folks' minds right now is public transit, specifically the MBTA and the commuter rail. We know that the Federal Transit Administration has been looking into the T, and Governor Baker said just last week that essentially it's up to the MBTA to prove that a federal takeover is not the right way to go. Do you believe that the FTA should take over the T operations?
We need to do something drastic. I mean, the fact that we are shutting down entire transit lines right now due to overdue maintenance is absurd. I mean, think about how long the MBTA has been around. Think about how many decades of good service it's been able to provide. I don't think there's another time in our history when we've just had to shut down an entire line. I mean, when's the last time they just completely shut down I-93 or I-95 for a month because they hadn't done the required maintenance? This isn't rocket science.
Right.
Railways have been around for over 100 years, and we know how to repair them, and yet the T cannot get the job done.
Yeah, we need to do something drastic. Is that a yes?
Look, I don't know if the FTA is the right solution, but I know that we cannot continue business as usual. I don't have any confidence in the leadership and organization of the T right now, and I don't know why anyone else in Massachusetts should either. So perhaps a federal takeover is the best option. I think every option should be on the table. There's no question that we can't just patch it up and continue pretending that nothing is wrong. Again, this is a fundamental failure. If you drive a car and never, ever change the oil, guess what? At some point, you're going to need a new car. It's not going to be enough just to repair the old thing you got. You're going to need a brand new car. And that's where we are right now with the MBTA.
Okay. Congressman Seth Moulton, we got about another minute or so to go with you. One last question on a different topic. I know one that hits home for you. You are a former active duty U.S. Marine who served four tours in Iraq. Last year on August 15th, Kabul fell in Afghanistan. The U.S. completed its withdrawal from Afghanistan by the end of the month. We talked to you then. You were highly critical of the administration's handling of the withdrawal. 1 year later, how are you thinking about that now?
Sadly, things have only gotten worse for the Afghans that we left behind, because we did leave a lot of Afghans behind, allies who trusted us with their lives because they put their lives on the line, not just for their country, but for ours. Our troops made them a promise that we get them out. And thousands of them are still left in the country. Mm-hmm. So it's a sad day. It's a sad anniversary. And it's a reminder that we still have a lot to do to keep our promises.
Okay, thank you very much. U.S. Congressman Seth Moulton, we'll check back with you, I'm sure, soon from the Massachusetts 6th District. Congressman Moulton, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Hate continues to show itself in Boston.
Wearing masks and parading through the streets of downtown Boston, a white supremacist group called Patriot Front made their presence known.
Drag queen story hours targeted.
I'm doing just fine. What I worry about is the kids who were leaving the event who had to walk through that demonstration from this neo-Nazi group.
That sound from CBS Boston and from our show, drag performer Patty Bure, on our show on July 28th. All of it together led Rachel Rollins, United States Attorney for the District of Massachusetts, to create a hotline for people to report hate anonymously. The hotline has been active for just about 2 weeks. Back with us now to tell us how it's going, U.S. Attorney Rachel Rollins. Attorney Rollins, thanks for joining us.
Of course.
How's the hotline going so far?
It's going great. 1-833-END-HATE-NOW, H-8-N-O-W. We've had over 50 calls since we first launched the hotline. Mm-hmm. And we want to encourage people to, if they are concerned or an act of violence has happened or they're in any danger, they always need to call 911. That's what we want people to know. If they are in fear for their lives or safety, they need to call 911. But there are individuals that might not be comfortable calling about an incident that they personally experienced that they believe might be a hate crime or concerns that they might have about a loved one that has espoused an ideology that's troubling and maybe is now talking about threats or acts of violence against themselves or others. That's what the 1-833-END-HATE-NOW line is for. And we've had a really robust response since opening, I believe, on August 3rd.
What types of calls have you been getting on that line?
So we get individuals. I want to be clear. There are certainly some people that have taken the time to call to say that they're not happy that the line is set up. But overall, we get individuals that are calling concerned about things that they've witnessed, either acts of vandalism using hateful language targeting, for example, let's say the LGBTQ community, or incidents targeting the Jewish community or the Black community or some other protected community. There are other individuals that have said that, they have been targeted based on their race and they are white. And I have personally started calling back each of the individuals on the line and explaining to them that if they believe a crime happened, they should call 911. And some of the individuals I've spoken to personally, others I've left a message and we're working our way through. But when we do get calls that are concerning, and they all are concerning, obviously, if they're claiming that they were harmed or threatened with harm, we pass those along to law enforcement. And we are really excited about the robust response we've had. There's certainly an appetite for this type of assistance from the federal government. Mm-hmm.
So this is leading you to some good tips that you and law enforcement will be able to follow up on?
Absolutely. And what I want to really do is give a shout out to the FBI, who has exceptional agents and people working at their agency that are, you know, specialize in this type of these types of investigations, as well as local police departments. You know, I work often in my previous role, used to all the time, but now as U.S. attorney with the Boston Police Department and the Mass State Police. But we have several local police departments that are actively working on making sure that the residents and their communities feel comfortable. And remember, sir, there's the difference between a hate incident and a hate crime. And even if we can't press charges per se, federal charges or state or local charges, the AG or the DA's office, hate incidents are something that law enforcement should be aware of. If there was something that the community found really troubling, you know, we'll give the example of the Pride facility that happened sadly a few weeks ago that was vandalized and targeted, and the language that was spray painted on that work site, because the facility hasn't been built yet, made clear that they wanted to harm, burn, or kill members of the LGBTQ community. Even though we have not made arrests yet in that circumstance, because that obviously rises to the level of a threat, the community is still deeply impacted by the fact that that happened. And it was a hate incident that law enforcement needs to be aware of, community leaders need to be aware of, so that we can get wraparound services to all the members of that community that had to live through that experience.
Sure. For our listeners, can you define the difference between a hate incident and a hate crime? Is the difference what's prosecutable?
Yes, you are absolutely right. So it is a hate crime requires a criminal act. And remember, espousing an ideology that, you know, may be repugnant to some is not a crime. Essentially, when you are stating your hatred of a group, even though we might, you know, all believe that this is not, you know, appropriate language to be used, it is protected by the First Amendment. When speech becomes a crime is when it crosses into threats, right? So the example that we talked about, sadly, with the Pride facility, when you use words like we're going to burn this down and you know, kill and things like that, that does not leave anything to the imagination. And those can be prosecutable. We recently charged somebody who called and made threats regarding the dictionary, Webster Dictionary company in Massachusetts. The building had to be evacuated, and the individual had been making threats and calls. Although nothing physically happened, those verbal words were enough to cross the line into a crime. A hate incident is something that, you know, for example, somebody screaming a racial slur or something anti-Semitic at somebody, or even, you know, like threatening or making some derogatory statements against individuals that are white. If you are protected by certain categories regarding, you know, the laws that we have in our not only state and federal government. So we would be making sure that an incident was documented, or that the police were aware of it, even though they couldn't bring charges, because that impacts community. But individuals can do things like get potentially, you know, go to get a stay away order from somebody. If it's a neighbor that might not involve law enforcement, they can go on their own if this in things like this have happened more than three times and they have documented it. So there's a lot of information we can be giving to people.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with United States Attorney Rachel Rollins. If you can you tell us, is this type of thing happening online? The incident, the hate incidents, is it happening online, and what can you do to track that?
Absolutely. If you read the news today, actually, there is an article about the fact that Boston Children's Hospital has been receiving some, and these are their words. I read the article just like everyone else today, but threats is what they are saying regarding the transgender health program that they have. And, you know, I need to make clear, people are permitted to agree or disagree, whether it is based in science or not. We are all entitled to our feelings, and we can use appropriate channels to make it known that we disagree with things. But when it crosses into the level of threats, that is when we are potentially going to have a law enforcement response to this incident. And we have seen people threatening online. We have heard about incidents, for example, sir, at UMass Amherst over the last several months, and maybe even over the last year, of people, African-American Black students, receiving emails or messages that are disparaging and hateful. Whether those raise to the level of a crime or not is a legal question. But when, you know, individuals are receiving that, how are, you know, the university has to respond in a way that is helpful to all of their students, right? So whether there are crimes committed or whether there are violations of administrative, you know, policies or procedures or student handbook rules, those are all different levels of inquiry that maybe the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office won't be involved in, or a DA's office or the AG if it's an administrative, you know, or student handbook violation. Mm-hmm. But students are still feeling harmed when things like that happen. Boston Children's Hospital is still feeling fear when they are engaging in providing, sure, health care to all children, including transgender children, and allowing them to be their authentic selves and supporting them on their journey with, a guardian or a parent, mm-hmm, that is actively involved and supportive.
How is the hotline helping you to uncover these hate group members without infringing on their protected rights? You mentioned the First Amendment. Yep. As repugnant as some of these messages are, they do have First Amendment rights. And a lot of these groups seem to be pushing the envelope just to the edge. How do you make sure they don't step over that line?
No, it's a great question. And, you know, we have tip lines for everything, right? With violent crime, we tell people to drop a dime all the time, right? That rhyme was mine. I don't think they do that on their own. But like, literally, there are tips lines that the Boston Police Department has had for years and years and years. The FBI has 1-800-CALL-FBI for any tip or any information that they think, that you think the FBI might need to know. This is simply the same exact opportunity, but when it comes to hate. And we made it clear, you know, in my press release about the number, we are interested in concerning or troubling incidents of hate, potential hate crimes, or concerns regarding individuals believed to be espousing hate-filled views or actions. And then I went on to say that we learned far too often in the wake of mass shootings and or acts of hate-based violent extremism. So, sir, for example, when we hear after an incident that, oh, wow, he uploaded a video of himself, you know, a cartoon video of himself shooting up a school, or when asked what he was going to do for the summer, he said a murder-suicide. And, you know, ultimately the police were involved and he spent 2 days in a mental health facility and his parents still purchased firearms for him after the fact. Those are all relevant things that maybe possibly law enforcement might not have known about with respect to the video. Mm-hmm. But if you were in that private chat room and didn't know that individual or saw something concerning, that is the type of thing. If they said something about, look, I want to kill or I want to harm or I'm thinking about doing something like this to insert a protected group, irrespective of color, at all. And I want to be clear, this does not only This applies to anyone, any race, color, religion, national origin, sexual orientation, gender, gender identity, or disability. Anyone. This is not only exclusive Black or Brown or Jewish. It's protecting everyone.
Okay. United States Attorney Rachel Rollins, thanks for joining us today. I'm going to mention that number one more time, and it will be on our website, radioboston.org. The number is 1-83-END-HATE-NOW. Rachel Rollins, thanks for joining us today.
Be well.
It's August 17th, and that means we're days away from going back to school fully in person, and we have questions.
This year, there's going to be new rules and new schedules.
But when so many things are different, how do we know what to expect?
What do we do to get ready? And what if something goes wrong?
That's from YouTube's show Kid Correspondent, and those might be some of the lighter questions you'll be fielding in the next few days. Here to help me answer some of the heavier ones are Dr. Almi Abeda, the superintendent of Chelsea Public Schools, and Omar Ruiz, licensed marriage and family therapist out of Wellesley and the owner of Talk, Think, Thrive, offering online and in-person relationship counseling services. Almi, Omar, welcome.
Thank you so
much. Thank you. Thank you.
It's nice to have you both here. So Massachusetts saw a 50% increase in anxiety and depression diagnoses among kids from 3 to 17 from 2016 to 2020. That's data from the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Obviously, 2020 was pre-pandemic. Almi, from what you've seen, does a 50% increase in youth anxiety and depression sound just about right?
It does, and we are very very familiar with the numbers, and that does sound right for where we are right now.
Mm-hmm. Omar, how about you? A 50% increase, does that make sense for what you're seeing in your practice?
I would say so. I've also seen that when I was working as a middle school counselor before, just recently, and that is a combination of both trying to integrate socially back into an in-person model, as well as trying to transition from, I'm hoping, a post-COVID world, but now an integration of also monkeypox.
Mm-hmm. School has been weird, full stop. Almi, is this the year that everything returns to normal? And if so, what does normal look like?
I would say it's semi-normal. You know, we always hope to say go back to normal. But I think after everything that we've been through as a whole, the normal is no longer the normal. And so we're learning to live with COVID, and we're learning to live with everything that comes our way. I think we as educators as a whole, we've learned to adapt and pivot when necessary. So I would say the normal that we long for is no longer in existence. But what we can say is that for us, we're heading into a second year where we're starting school in person, and we celebrate that. We're excited to be back in school, back in person, and then we are just excited that we kind of know what we're doing, and with COVID, and we don't have all the social distancing and all the protocols. So we are getting back to normal, but there's still a part of us that has to acknowledge that we've been through a lot.
Do you feel that you have all the tools you need to have a successful back to school season?
I do feel like we have the tools that we need, but we still have to remember that our students need a lot of support. Our teachers still need a lot of support. We can't forget that there's still trauma out there. There's still mental health issues. We still have to be cognizant of that. We still have to address all the mental health issues that our students have. And we have to educate and focus on teaching and learning. But we also have to remember that some of our students are still struggling.
What are the kids worried about?
Well, right now, what I would say, we have freshman orientation happening this week. And we've had 200 students this year, yesterday, and we have another group of students today, and I was talking to the person who's overseeing this work, and he's like, Ami, they just have the regular mixed emotions that students normally have. They're coming into a new school. They're like, I'm a freshman. I'm in ninth grade. And so there's an excitement. I'm in high school. And so there's the normal, like, you know, the normal, like, I'm in a new school. I'm excited. I have mixed feelings. But again, I don't, as far as what students are worried about, there's a myriad of issues that our students are worried about. I think for us and Chelsea, we're very cognizant of the fact that our students, many of our students in the older grades are balancing work and school. And so we are always thinking about ways to meet students' needs, whether it's through one of our alternative mm-hmm. schools, and it's called Chelsea Opportunity Academy. We recently opened a fully virtual school, single district virtual school called Chelsea Virtual Learning Academy to meet different needs of our students and with that. So we're just trying to really meet our students' needs and provide a portfolio of options for our students.
Sure. Omar Ruiz here in the studio with me, licensed marriage and family therapist. Does that ring true with you? Is that what you're hearing from the kids you deal with that they're concerned about?
I would say so. And I would also want to include the unfortunate concerns and fears around potential school shootings that have existed throughout the past years. Of course, in the height of COVID, it didn't exist because everyone was online. But that is also a concern that parents have when having students return back in school, in addition to the health crises that is plaguing us in this global community, in addition to just normal sense of anxiety of just entering into a new community back in person and trying to normalize a sense of social relationships.
Those are concerns that have gone on back when I was a kid. Will, mm-hmm. will my friends accept me? Am I wearing the right clothes? All those things, those are still there.
Correct.
Plus, you pile on top school shootings, COVID, mm-hmm. other concerns like that.
Mm-hmm.
I want to play for you some sound from Brenda Daly, who is an associate director and clinician at Whittier Street Health Center in Roxbury. She left us a voicemail about some of the symptoms that they've been seeing.
We are seeing young children as well as teens who are presenting with anxiety symptoms related to fears of uncertainty of whether COVID-19 virus would continue to be a factor in disruption to their school life. Symptoms such as constant worry and negative thinking, irritability, waking through the night with bad dreams, and finding it hard to concentrate.
Now, Brenda says that parents should be aware of this, and if they see this change as school nears, they should speak with their child's pediatrician. Almy, does Chelsea have any of the resources that you're rolling out this year? Anything that you're sending before school starts that parents can use?
Well, we do have all of our welcome back open houses next week. And so at our open houses, we have all of our partner organizations that work with mental health. And so it's really an opportunity. We come together as a community at our welcome back open houses and provide a ton of resources for our families. We provide backpacks. We call all of our partners, become their present. And so we are really working to meet the needs of all the needs of our students. And mental health is definitely up front and center and on top.
Mm-hmm. Omar, I want to ask you, are there some questions that parents can ask their elementary school child to check in with them about how they're feeling about the new school year? I remember when my kids were small, you know, they come home, hey, how was your day? Oh, good. That was about it. But are there some more probing questions that parents can ask their kids to really draw out from them where they are at mentally and socially and everything?
So I would say, for parents of specifically elementary school students, to ask more open-ended questions about their day, ask them about what did they learn, who did they spend time with, what did they want to take away from the class lessons. I think if we just ask general questions of how was your day, it might seem more flat for students because or children, because it is more of like a, it's okay, it's fine, and you don't necessarily get a rich description of their experience. And if it's older kids, you want to be a bit more involved as far as the social aspect. Mm-hmm. Did you meet anybody new today? Do you feel safe? Do you feel comfortable? And then so forth.
Yeah, so some kids are talkers, some are not, just like adults. Are there any signs that parents should be on the lookout for how to know if their child is feeling anxious about the new school year, Omar?
I would say anxiety tends to show up first with their body, elevated heart rate, sweaty palms, pacing back and forth. Normally, kids, when they want to avoid a specific conversation, they're going to give you very short responses, like, I'm okay, I'm fine, nothing's wrong. However, it is okay and it is in the right of the parent to continue asking questions and say, okay, if you're not comfortable answering that now, I'll check in with you afterwards. Mm-hmm. When it comes to other behavioral symptoms that you want to look out for is, are they locking themselves in their room? Are they trying to avoid conversations? Are they spending too much time involved in their phones? And these are just some aspects might be just connected to them just mm-hmm. normally going on their phones, but especially when it comes to the start of the school year, I would suggest parents to pay attention mm-hmm. to those things.
Almia Beda, the superintendent of Chelsea Public Schools, does that ring true with you as well and the children in your district?
I would say so. I think Omar provided some great signs to look for. And as Omar said, you know, some kids are a little bit more extroverted or introverted than others, and it's just important to pay attention. I think if you see a change in your child's behavior, definitely note it. And like you said, you know, try to ask those open-ended questions. I know for myself as a parent, I remember those, like, how was your day at school? Fine. You know, so it's just I learned how to ask a little bit more open-ended questions so I can try to get more information. Mm-hmm. But again, if parents are seeing a sudden change in a student, or it's important to pay attention.
Yeah, when should a parent seek professional help for their child's anxiety? Omar, I'll start with you.
I would say if they're noticing changes in their behaviors that are a pattern within 2 weeks, at that point, that's when you should start considering tracking some of those changes. If you're getting phone calls from the school, if your child is not responding to you as they normally would, especially how they were in the summer, that's when you want to consider reaching out to the school, speaking to them about what are they noticing in terms of changes in behaviors. Are they quiet, or are they finding themselves in the bathroom teary-eyed? It's important to first contact a school just to get some information before you decide to do some outreach to maybe a clinic, a hospital, or even reaching out to a counselor in a private practice field.
Mm-hmm. A lot of parents have anxiety about sending their kids back to school. How can a parent make sure that they don't transfer that anxiety onto their kids?
I think it's important for parents to take the accountability and responsibility to be in touch with school staff, specifically the principal, dean of students, assistant principal, and specifically the school counselor. I think it's important to understand the protocols, the policies, and the procedures that the schools have in place as far as if there's any health or safety concerns that might come up, if there's any bullying that's happening either online or in person that maybe staff become aware of, and what can they do as a school to inform the parents, and then from there, any steps or procedures that the parents can take from at that point.
You just mentioned staff. Almi, how is your staff helping students deal with these stressors?
We're very fortunate. We have a cadre of school counselors and social workers, and I feel very fortunate to have the group that we do have. And so we've done initial screening of a lot of our students. Last year, we actually, for the first time, we did a mental health screening for all of our students. And so we have a pretty good grasp of who, you know, which students we're kind of watching, you know. Mm-hmm. And then we have we just have to know our kids. And we're really trying, I'm really trying to stress this year that we have to know our students by name, strength and story. And so that means really every adult knowing a child by their name, by their strength and their story. What are they going through? Who are our students? And so really, and once we know who our students are, then we can, the key is relationships too. So one thing that I think is super important is that we know our students, that our student has an adult with at least a few people, you know, one person a student can go to have a connection to and say, you know what, I might be struggling in this area, or the adult knows the child so well that he or she can say, you know what, I think we let me refer, you know, I'm going to refer the student to a guidance counselor or to a social worker. And so really just focusing on who our kids are and having relationships with them.
We're talking about kids' mental health and back to school. Well, on the line is Almi Abeda, the superintendent of the Chelsea Public Schools. And here in the studio, Omar Ruiz, a licensed marriage and family therapist, former school counselor. I want to think specifically about high school students now for a moment, because their challenges are a little bit different. We reached out to our text group about this. If you want to join the group, the number is 617-766-0382. Here's a voicemail from Sandy in Arlington about her daughter.
My daughter will be a junior and is very anxious about this school year because she feels like everything is on the line if she'd like to go to a good college, as she puts it. It's been drilled into her over time that junior year is, you know, the make it or break it year. And for a 16-year-old to feel that her whole life, her whole future is dependent on this one period of time, it's incredible pressure.
With the pandemic taking up so much of our brain space, sometimes we forget that the quote-unquote normal stresses are still there. We talked about that a little while ago. Omar, what sort of advice do you give kids and parents when they're feeling this pressure? Maybe it's not college. Maybe it's the overwhelming question of what to do with the rest of your life.
I would say to just have a very genuine and transparent conversation as a family, to be able to understand what is it that they would hope for their experience of this year. Knowing that some students are going to be prepping for PSATs and SATs and college application, that process. What is it that they're going to need from each other to be able to be supportive throughout the year outside of the supports that they can get from school?
Mm-hmm. Almi, how about you?
I would say the exact same thing. I also just, you know, we have to remember we need to support our students through this process. And it's okay that they may not know what they want to do in the future. I remember having that conversation with my own student, my own child, and it's like, it's okay for you not to know what you want to do for the rest of your life right now at this age.
Okay.
And that's okay.
Thank you. Almi and Omar, thank you for joining us today. Almi Abeda is the superintendent of Chelsea Public Schools, and Omar Ruiz is a licensed marriage and family therapist out of Wellesley and the owner of Talk, Think, Thrive, offering online and in-person relationship counseling services. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beelan, and Sydney Bowles, with Bart Tocci and Andrea Perdamo Hernandez. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director. Titus Folladoon is our executive producer. I'm Steve Brown. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.